What's better in life than a bottle of wine, great food, and an amazing conversation?
My name is Kate Sullivan, and I am the host of To Dine For.
I'm a journalist, a foodie, a traveler with an appetite for the stories of people who are hungry for more. Dreamers, visionaries, artists, those who hustle hard in the direction they love. I travel with them to their favorite restaurant to hear how they did it. This show is a toast to them and their American dream. To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by American National, offering a broad suite of insurance solutions to protect what matters most to you. For 115 years, American National has remained committed to helping people and communities make a real difference in their lives. American National supports great local community organizations led by the kind of people you hear about on To Dine For. People who are inspired to make a difference and inspire others in return. American National's philosophy is helping where it's needed helps us all. For a description of the American National companies, the products they write, and the states in which they're licensed, visit americannational.com/dine. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dine For, the podcast, where we meet the world's most creative and innovative minds at their favorite restaurant. On today's episode is James Freeman.
I had this idea of what coffee could be, and in my naivete, I was shocked that people could care less about coffee when it's their profession than I did as an amateur in my kitchen.
James Freeman is the founder of Blue Bottle Coffee, a brand he started in 2002 in a modest 186-square-foot shed in Oakland, California. From a freelance clarinetist, he transformed into a coffee entrepreneur, creating a company with numerous roasteries and over 100 cafes across the U.S. and Asia. Celebrated as Coffee Professional of the Year by Imbibe magazine and listed among Fast Company's 100 most creative people in business, James's influence extends beyond the coffee industry. He's also an author of The Blue Bottle Craft of Coffee and has been featured in prominent publications like The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and CBS This Morning. Today, Freeman serves as the creative director for Blue Bottle Studio and enjoys blending his professional pursuits with the joys of fatherhood. I can't wait to dive into this conversation with James Freeman. Hi, James. How are you?
I'm all right. It's a beautiful day in Ohio.
Wonderful. Is that where you are? You're Ohio, California?
Yeah. I moved here about 8 months pre-pandemic, which was good timing. And Ohio quarantine is not like a San Francisco quarantine.
That is amazing. I was in Montecito last Monday. I'd never been. It was beautiful. It's very close.
It's beautiful.
It's close to Ohio, is it not?
Yeah, like 40-minute drive, like that.
Yeah.
Not far. Yeah, there was a lot of rain there. So there's some mudslides. So it's a little damp right now. But it's hopefully people are drying out.
I am so excited to talk to you today. I cannot wait to dive into your story and hear everything Blue Bottle Coffee related and beyond. But I'm going to begin this podcast the way I begin all my podcasts by asking your favorite restaurant. You live in California currently, but I'm sure you have been to many a restaurant. Where would you take me if you could only take me to one?
Oh my. Olivia warned me that you might be asking that question. And it's like, all right, sorry, this is going to be long and complicated. I ate very, very well all over the world, as you might imagine, for 10 years, like 2008, 2018, the decade of tasting menus, like ate at Noma in Copenhagen.
You did?
Dome and,
you did?
Yeah.
And did you book your flight just to eat there?
No. It was one of the, like, I knew a fresh chef friend who was buddies with Renee, and I was going, and it's like, Daniel, can you help us get in? And
we
did, and it was amazing. Dome and Sao Paulo, incredible. And then I had my like midlife health reckoning almost exactly 6 years ago, Valentine's Day, 2018. And it caused me, I got actually much, much healthier after that. But it caused me to kind of reevaluate my relationship with food.
Mm.
And
what do you mind sharing what that health reckoning was?
Oh, yeah. I lost hearing in this year, 1 year. And it was like poorly understood. And was it a virus? And was I going to lose my hearing in both? And I used to be a classical musician. And just got a stereo, like a stereo that I wanted, you know, and I would go to the symphony. And even losing one hearing in one ear is actually quite disorienting because you lose your sense of spatial perception.
Sure.
And so the simple act of crossing busy street is suddenly more charged because you can't like tell where the cars are coming.
Yep.
And what I didn't realize at that time, but did after studying, is that when music enters the left ear, that's when it gets processed. That's when it gets interpreted and understood. And so like I had kind of lost my relationship to music, which had been
wow.
a near constant companion. And also sonically chaotic environments were very disturbing for me to be in. What's more sonically chaotic than a busy cafe, right? Mm-hmm. So going to the symphony, going to a cafe, walking a city street, suddenly were things that I had lost any ability to participate in. And so it was quite, you know, there's worse health reckonings, cancer, you know, all that. But still, it was a hard time.
And what caused you to lose it? What prompted
it? They said that the doctor said it was like some sort of virus that there wow. are occasional clusters and there's inflammation of like the coating around the audio nerve. And so it caused me to, for the first time in my life, it's like, all right, I'm going to make some different choices around what I eat. I went on the anti-inflammation diet that half of San Francisco seemed to be on at that time. Prior, like I could not walk past a patisserie. And then I had just started, oddly, studying Muay Thai. And so I doubled down on that. I made different choices about what I ate. And then all of a sudden, I got my hearing back. The audiologist, a couple months later, said, wow, I've never seen a recovery like that in my career. And he was my age.
The hearing came back in both ears.
Both ears. Yeah.
And
almost 100%.
And do you credit your diet for that?
I mean, I think, you know, I think making different choices around what I ate, like looking very closely at how I'd lived my life. And because it was at the end, the Blue Bottle transaction with Nestle was a handful of months before that.
Wow. Could it have been stress? Could it have stress have done it?
Yeah, all of it, you know,
right.
Stress. And also, you know, not to be too ohai about it, but it's like, what wasn't I wanting to listen to, right?
Mm, wow.
You know, and so really trying to look deep into things like that.
That's really interesting. I'm on a health journey of my own. And, you know, I believe in everything you're saying. I think it all matters, right?
It all matters.
Yes.
It all matters. It all matters. And so with that reevaluation, like, well, why was it so hard for me to walk past a patisserie? Why did I want the premium wine pairings every time I went to a tasting? Why were the wine pairings not enough?
Yeah, right.
You know, and then move to Ojai, and there's basically three or four restaurants that I want to go to. And why do I go there? I like to cook, and I cook a lot. I've got two young kids, 6 and 8, and I'd rather just cook something delicious for them. But if I go out, I just want somebody to be nice to my kids and for them
yes.
to have a nice time and to use good ingredients. And now when I go out, I want nothing less than profundity. If I can't go out and have somebody move me to tears, it's like, I'd just rather cook at home.
No one has ever said that, James. That's a first into Dine For history. So if it's not the very best, if it's not profound, you don't want it.
Yeah. And, yeah. and you know, what is best? It's not like I demand to fly to Copenhagen or nothing.
Right.
For an example, I was up in San Francisco. I hadn't been there for a year. And in 1979, this French woman, Jacqueline, signed a lease on Grant Avenue. She was 45 when she signed that lease in 1979. And she opened a restaurant called Café Jacqueline. And what she does is she makes souffles. She only makes souffles.
Oh, wow.
There's actually a transcendent onion soup and a little butter lettuce salad. And so if she was 45 in 1979, she's 85 now. And she's the only one that makes souffles. And she's the only one that has ever made souffles at Cafe Jacqueline. There's a server that's worked there. His name is Matt. And he's worked there for about 30 years. I've been going there since he's been a server. He was a server for a couple years after I started. So I've been going there since the 90s. And they have, and I did a little math in my head when I was there. Jacqueline's probably made about 600,000
Wow.
Soufflés, and it takes a while. And Matt is their relationship, talk about profound, is a beautiful, he's very protective. He's devoted his life to that place and that relationship. The room hasn't changed since 1979. And I have a Gruyere souffle that Jacqueline has made after doing that for 45 years and follow up with a lime souffle. That's nothing short of magic. That's a privilege. That can't be bought, really, because Matt knows me for almost 30 years. So when I left a message on the voicemail, he was able to fit us in. But he's very protective of her time and energy. So she's only going to make 40 souffles a night now. So I felt lucky that I've had that long relationship and positive relationship with Matt that enabled this door to open so I could have this food that she's been working on nonstop. She started, there's no innovations in souffles. She started with a Gruyere souffle. She's going to end with a Gruyere souffle.
So is that your choice, Cafe Jacqueline?
Yeah, if I were pressed, then I would say that. Maybe you catch me on another day and it's going to be this place up in the mountains of Japan where they make soba or something like that. But that's the idea. Like, am I going to be near tears? Am I going to feel like there was some magic that was created that I was participating in?
Well, I love that answer. I really believe people's favorite restaurant reveals something about them. And, you know, the fact that you chose a restaurant that really shows a lot of passion, a lot of loyalty, a lot of dedication, and a lot of specificity. You know, there is something very specific about making a souffle and the art to it and the dedication to making it year after year. Let's begin at the very beginning. Oakland, there's a shed and you're a clarinetist. So take me from there. Where does the spark come from to create Blue Bottle Coffee?
I've been thinking about that a lot lately because I'm only tangentially involved. I'm in this very sort of deep sliver of Blue Bottle Coffee, this project called The Studio that's very meaningful for me. And that's basically the extent. I keep in touch with people. I'm friends with a handful of people that I care about that are doing good work there. But basically, you know, I have some influence at Blue Bottle, zero authority. And I'm a line item in a marketing budget with the studio.
But you started it, James.
Right? Oh, I like it. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It doesn't matter that you have no power now. I mean, we're here to hear your founder story. So take me from there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I tell you that to sort of contrast it with the beginning that same spark that caused me to feel so deeply about when was coffee roasted and how could I give people this idea that coffee is fresh food, to prepare a coffee to order. You know, this black coffee that I've been making black coffee for a long time, and that focus, that diligence, the fact that I am not tired of making coffee. I'm just getting more interested in making coffee. That spark was there within me and that started. I used to think it started with my training as a musician, because what do? We sit in a room all day, right? Practicing.
Same thing over and over. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think that spark of going very deep and seeking profundity in something as trivial as a chromatic scale or a book or a cheese souffle, there's something about me that had that spark from the beginning, that I wanted some sign, the heavens to open and to experience some profundity in anything that many people thought of as mundane or inconsequential.
So you are a clarinetist, and when did when did you go from an interest in coffee, because any person can make coffee themselves, to then thinking, I'm onto something, this could possibly be sold?
You know, that this is could possibly be, I didn't see it as a business idea. I saw it as a refuge. The most successful times in business with me and Blue Bottle have been moments where I didn't really know or care if other people would be interested. I was pleasing myself. And if I couldn't do the things, the creative work that inspired me, then I thought there was a decent chance that other people would be attracted to it. And in the beginning, it was very clear that's what happened. You know, I did stuff that I wanted to do. I was working out my own creative urgency around preparing coffee and creating spaces around coffee. And other people were very attracted to that process of somebody going deep. And it was a collaboration, you know, working with a team, but going very, very deep into sometimes pretty odd ideas for the time. And that attracted a lot of people. Had I been wondering like, oh, is this thing going to sell? Is that thing going to sell? Will this be popular? Will that be popular? It would have been a very, very different business. And I don't think so successful.
So how did it get started?
Blithe in ignorance, I think. I didn't know or realize how hard starting a business is. And I knew the farmer's market. It didn't seem hard to do something in the farmer's market. And so I was disenchanted with my path as a musician. I wasn't experiencing the type of depth in my relationship with my instrument, the success, the outward trappings of success that I wanted. I could touch it every once in a while, but I couldn't hold it. I'd always been very interested in coffee, made it as a musician in hotel rooms because I wanted that control. And I thought, well, yeah, I went to a culinary academy, had like this open house. I thought, well, I like desserts. Maybe I'll learn how to make desserts. And something didn't resonate with me and in a way that coffee did. So I had a little bit of money and some time in between being a clarinetist and starting Blue Bottle. And I just did it. If it was the timing was great because it was before a lot of people were talking about the things that I was interested in or cared about. Had the world been now where you can get coffee roasted all over the world with a date stamp on it and, you know, roasted very meticulously, and I wouldn't have felt the need to make some of that on my own. I would have just bought it.
What did you think was missing from the modern day coffee drinking experience that you felt like you could do, you knew, you could bring to the table?
I was very rooted in San Francisco. So I wasn't thinking about the world, really. I was thinking about San Francisco. And there were a few traditions of cafes in San Francisco. Pete's was one of them, you know, very dark roast. Cafe Trieste was another very like, sort of Italian influenced, Italian. There was a valence of Italianness over those. And then there were the kind of the San Francisco cafes, either with Java or Joe or Beans or Grinds with a Z in the name. And they would serve very haphazard French roast coffee, bottles of Peroni syrups, and espresso like on a dirty machine. And I'd been roasting coffee at home on a perforated baking sheet. And I knew what day three tasted like. And it was better than day two. You know, even though I was roasting very crudely, I had this idea of what coffee could be. And in my naivete, I was shocked that people could care less about coffee when it's their profession than I did as an amateur in my kitchen.
Ooh, that's good. Because you sensed that your passion and your care for what you were doing was greater than the professionals.
Yeah. And many times it was in that time. Not care for like a particular path in coffee. And even though I didn't know that much, it was great to start before the internet and social media were like yapping at us. Because, you know, I could think about things, have ideas that I thought were my own. You know, the what Instagram does is take the joy out of personal discoveries, right? You know, somebody's doing it in Thailand or Belarus. It's become this wash that flows over every influence. And I didn't have that. I feel fortunate.
That's interesting. You mean because we see so much, we don't have our own personal aha moment because we've seen it through other people?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, just look at the number of images you see now in a day versus how many you saw before you downloaded Facebook or Instagram. Mm,
yeah, that's true. Getting off topic here, but it especially refers to travel, because when you see the Taj Mahal for the first time, I've never seen the Taj Mahal, but I've seen it on Instagram many times. And I mean, feel like, what would that experience be like if I'd never seen that first reveal of the Taj Mahal through the lens of Instagram and just saw it with my own eyes?
Pretty powerful, I'm guessing. Yeah.
We'll have more on this conversation in just a minute. But first, thank you to our sponsors.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by American National, offering a broad suite of insurance solutions to protect what matters most to you. There's a funny thing about most insurance commercials, whether they feature lizards or birds or funny cartoon characters. It seems like they want you to think about anything but insurance. American National, on the other hand, has real local agents who get to know you, so they can help you reach better decisions about your insurance to make sure you're protecting what matters most to you. American National agents are part of your community. They're your neighbors. So whether it's solutions for your home, your small business, your farm, or your life, you can count on your local American National agent to make sure you get the discounts you deserve and the protection you need without paying for extras you don't. With American National, you get an ally, not just a web page. For a description of the American National companies, the products they write, in the states in which they're licensed, visit americannational.com/dine. Now back to our conversation.
So I'm guessing, you're having this passion. At what point do you think you could sell it?
Early, because my view was, okay, I just need to be really, really small. You know, if my expenses are really, really small and I have the tiniest possible roaster and the lowest possible rent, then I don't need to sell that much in order to make more than I made as a clarinetist, which wasn't that much.
Right, right, right. Keep your overhead low. Your overhead was already low. First rule of business,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
And what was the response? Did you start at farmers markets? Was that where you, or did you start selling out of your shed?
No. Started at farmers markets. And there was, coffee occupies a very interesting place in people's culinary personality, because 90% of the world drinks coffee or caffeine, some sort of caffeinated beverage every day. Many, many of those people drink coffee. If you do something every day, you feel like you're pretty good at it, even if you're not.
Right.
And you don't really want to be told that you're not that great at it, or there could be a better choice. So there was a lot of hearts and minds work that I did early on at the farmer's market. The nice thing about the farmer's market is, I'm at my table or at my espresso cart and people feel free to share their opinion. And I got many, many opinions about like peats and French roast and how you make a coffee and how hot it should be, like all of that stuff. And that was my opportunity to try to charm people into trying something different. Because I didn't want to do a French roast. People in Berkeley, especially the cradle of Alfred Peetz's coffee company. Yeah, I remember being grilled about how dark something was, this verbal Aikido, trying to gently deflect those thoughts, talk about something else that I thought was more important, and losing some of those interactions in terms of commerce, but winning many, many more. And then the nice thing is I could make drinks on the espresso cart. So as soon as they bought a drink, nine out of 10 were converted.
You strike me as an artist, first and foremost, obviously as a musical artist, and then in art, you can be an artist of coffee, and that's what you strike me as. So how do you translate your passion and, yes, your interest in selling this and scale it and make it bigger? And who was responsible for helping you bring Blue Bottle to what it is today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's something that I've really, really sat with over the years. And I think about, you know, my early life in Blue Bottle and the successes that came. And I think I was really more comfortable when scale was a noun and not a verb. That was where I was at my creative best.
Mm.
And then, you know, think about 2012 to 2017, where most of the growth of Blue Bottle was happening. Has there ever been an easier time to get investment for a business? I don't know if there there has been.
Right.
And I'm not saying it was easy. I had partners along the way. Brian Meehan was the first investor that came in 2012. And then that's when a lot of those investment rounds came. And he was very good at telling the story of Blue Bottle, attracting the right people at the right time. He was the single most helpful person in terms of attracting investment for the growth of Blue Bottle Coffee. And, I thought, well, why not? Like, there was a certain amount of ego in my thinking. And it's like, if I can do it at 6 cafes, I can do it at 100 cafes.
Mm.
And I wanted the audience. I wanted the applause. I wanted the acclaim. It was very intoxicating to be on the cover of a Japanese magazine.
Mm.
Right? And I let that, I think, chip away at the core creative impulse that let me start Blue Bottle. And that was my choice. But I think back, and you're right, it was a deeply, deeply creative act that I didn't really care about success. I wasn't thinking it. I liked success. I wanted success, but I didn't care. I wasn't doing it to be successful. And then when it shifted and there were a lot of people that had put a lot of money in, and the expectation is they would get their money back and then some. And I wanted that too for them. I didn't want to lose their investment. That was important for me. Then that changed the calculus. And it was not a deeply creative act for me anymore. There were threads, there were elements, but it became about, like, all right, what's the model? How do we make money from this? How do we pay back our investors? And can we manage to stay creative through this?
And where was your first or biggest pain point in that, you know, from inception to that time period you're talking about? You know, because I see it, you know, unless you have the business skills and acumen and drive, they're almost like, you rarely see them in one person, right? You usually see
them, they're
right?
Not in
they're usually two totally different paths. And so it's always fascinating to me to hear the story of someone who starts out a founder, right? There's a reason why I love interviewing founders, because they are the visionary, they are the spark, they are the artist, right? And then to then have to translate that into a profitable business is a completely different animal. I'm just wondering, how difficult, can you take me to a difficult part of that journey and how you were able to overcome it?
I mean, parenthetically, Blue Bottle Coffee for the first, like from founding 2002 to 2012 was always profitable. I took a lot of pride from using the constraints that I had, some of which were economic, and making those part of the creative process. Our art is about constraint. Mm-hmm. I think there was a legitimate dose of the human capacity for self-deception that I was in, where I thought, like, oh, I can stay creative, even though I'm not the majority owner of Blue Bottle anymore. I can deeply work out all my weirdo coffee stuff and have it be acclaimed throughout the world. I can do that. Why not? So there's a little bit of ego and self-deception involved with my thinking that things could be just more and more creative rather than less and less. And so the hardest part for me, I think, was when I was starting to be removed from making coffee and being deep into, and I don't mean working shifts, but being deep into the making of coffee and designing stores around a certain experience that I wanted people to have.
Mm-hmm.
and then hearing constraints, financial constraints, primarily around the building of stores, as not being interesting creative solutions, but being constraints that made the process less creative rather than more creative. I feel like I told myself I didn't have time to really dig deep when we were opening 30 stores one year. I forget what year it was, 2014. That I convinced myself I didn't have time to go really, really, really deep on every single store to make it a marvel, to make it a miracle, given the constraints around time to build and cost to build.
Mm.
And so I kind of relinquished my creative capacity in a certain way during that time of extreme growth. And I caused it to, I mean, this is maybe behind the whole ear thing. I didn't really listen to the voice inside me that was like, hey, wait, I don't think you can do this. I don't think you can feel creative yet not be creative.
Mm.
Well, and that tension existed in me.
Yeah, because creativity is not a theory, it's an act. So you have to actually,
it's a verb.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So if you had to explain to someone who's never tried Blue Bottle Coffee, what sets it apart and what was your vision at the beginning for the company?
My vision for the company was usually at the time synopsized in three words, deliciousness, hospitality, and sustainability. I wanted people to feel that, but I didn't want to club people over the head with it.
Mm.
So I, once again, the show don't tell was very important for me. I'm very sensitive to words and language, and I didn't want a lot of clutter of language, of this draping of explaining experience. You walk into a store, say a Sweetgreen, and I admire what they're doing at Sweetgreen, but they are so much explaining about how great they are,
right?
You know, their brand statement, you're like this, that. You go into coffee companies too, the same thing. We only use the finest, we travel the world. And what that does is it leeches language of its power.
Mm.
And so if there's only a few words there, then they stand out. Mm. And if you treat people as though they're smart and capable and have eyes and ears and other sensory organs, right, then they'll understand by just being in a space, just by tasting something, just by hearing some kind words come out of a barista. I wanted to create sort of an empty space where people could have a more powerful experience rather than fill it with chatter. Look at here, look at this, don't forget that. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't you order online next time? You know, like all of that.
Well, you just answered my next question, which was about minimalist aesthetic of Blue Bottle Coffee. Obviously, that was intentional. You've kind of intimated at that.
Yeah.
What else about that very clean line, very simplistic signage? Obviously, that came from you. What else was part of the experience? Was music a part of, like, was there intentionality to the music that, especially with your background, that was played at the stores?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I used to take a lot of pleasure, like thinking about a space, thinking about the shape of the space, the material set, and like going on eBay and buying a cool old stereo that I thought would sound good in that space, because the sensory environment, the sound of a place is part of the sensory environment, right?
How yes.
things, you don't want to walk in and have it smell like a dish room,
right?
So there's the olfactory environment, there's the sonic environment. Obviously the taste is very important. The visual environment is very important. I used to think about the first touch all the time. I spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about doorknobs and door pulls during a certain phase because I didn't want it to to be cold. You know, those storefront
yes. mm-hmm.
metal doors, it's usually a metal door pull.
Yes.
And I thought, well, that's a bad first touch, right? That's the first time somebody's touching the store, touching your product, literally. If your cafe is your product, that's the first time. So I remember in Japan, we had wood dowel. It was quite nice. One place in Oakland, it was leather wrapped. That was fun for me to think about somebody else, like this deep empathy mm-hmm. for a guest coming in before they've had coffee. Mm-hmm. People are vulnerable before they've had coffee.
ain't that the truth?
Isn't it the truth? So this idea, I never wanted minimalism. I never said, oh, it's got to be you know, I want a minimal environment. What it was like, all right, let's justify every object in this place. And if it contributes to this experience of a delicious coffee in a hospitable environment, then yes, we'll have that. But if it doesn't contribute, if it's a decoration, if it's an ornament, why does it need to be there? If it's a pattern, all it's going to do is distract from the beautiful pattern that's on top of somebody's cappuccino.
You appear to have really, as you stated at the very beginning of this conversation, to really have held on to your passion for coffee making. And I would think after all that you have
it's
been
exhausting.
But after all that you've been through, that would be a real victory in your life, that you aren't sick of it, right? Like you still love it. Like that to me, if I were you, I would consider that a huge win.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, it's nice to have that reflected, because like even deeper, I'm working on a couple crazy things, just, I don't know if they're businesses or not, just on my own time. But there's like a depth to my relationship with making coffee and serving coffee that has only increased over the last few years. And I think, you know, part of it is just, you know, I'm hardly drinking alcohol these days. I'm eating beautiful food, but it's on the healthier, you know, I have a little more rigorous in my habits. And so what's left, I have fewer distractions. Mm-hmm. And then what's left sensorially is coffee.
Yeah, that's awesome. That, I mean, it's a great hobby. You know, whether you go on and create your own company or not, it's a really wonderful hobby. You are the creative director for Blue Bottle Studio. What does that entail?
That the studio was the result of me thinking, what is the pinnacle experience, or what ought the pinnacle experience for Blue Bottle Coffee? What should that be? And it was in contrast with me going to the Starbucks Reserve Roastery. Right? That's Howard's pinnacle experience. And it's no shade on Howard. You know, he's created an industry, and I'm quite grateful for what Starbucks has done in this industry. I have a few qualms, but in general, I'm very grateful. And, you know, pinnacle experience is 20,000 square feet, and there's copper tubing and a pizzeria and a cocktail bar. And so I wanted to boil down, what would the pinnacle experience for Blue Bottle be? It's 400 square feet and a record player, basically, and, you know, a few cups. And so a colleague that I find particularly inspiring, his name's Benjamin Brewer, and he and I were talking before the pandemic about that. What might it be? What kind of illuminated truth could we bring to a small amount of people with the fewest number of tools? And how could we examine our feelings about coffee, not about pizza or cocktails particularly? How could it be calm and basically show what's in our minds when we think about coffee? And that became the studio. I was fortunate that that idea was embraced by the company. They saw the power in having a pinnacle experience like that. And so we started in Kyoto last spring. I was working in Kyoto making coffee during cherry blossom time. It was quite powerful and moving.
Why did you choose Kyoto as the location for the first Blue Bottle Studio?
Oh, if you could make coffee anywhere in the world, would you choose Kyoto during cherry blossom? So there was that. But also, there's a very beautiful cafe in Kyoto, the first one. Joe Nagasaka was the architect. I worked with him on that. It's a 100-year-old machia. And there was a room, a beautiful room, that wasn't really being used. So that was a pretty easy place to test that. And the Japan team, wonderful, very passionate, deep thinkers about coffee. And we had all the gear. So that was the first. And it was about 10 courses, variations on our ideas about coffee. It took a long time, a couple of years, to work out all those tastes. And then we moved to LA, and that was in October, and that was in an old laundromat. And I was able to work a lot of coffee services there because it's so close. I would stay there every other week. And the woman that was in charge of training the baristas, Selena Vergara, she's a longtime manager of the Blue Bottle Abbott Kinney shop. You know, having her as part of that too, there were a lot of great people on that team. But it became this very, very deep experience. Like people literally cried at the counter sometimes.
The people who are working there or the people who are tasting the coffee?
Both.
Both. And why were they crying, James?
Well, it became, I can't speak for them, but the reason I did it was just like very moving and deep. It was the way it evolved with these wonderful people I was working with, some of them quite young, but just the reverence without pomposity, the sincerity of the service, just the act of like putting a cup on the table. I could tell my colleagues were thinking about that. They were paying attention. I was bringing dishes back to the back room where I had a tray of dirty dishes at the end of one service. And there were three baristas in the back room cleaning, you know, because we would have, there's a lot of little dishes we'd have to clean in between services. There were three services a day. And I was bringing this tray of dishes, and there are three of them back there, and they could have been like chit-chatting or whatever, like, you know, nobody could hear them. But they were taking each dish, dirty dish, placing it on the sink, washing it, like placing it on the tray. They were still deep in that mindset of reverence and sincerity. And it was very moving. It was very moving. And just the way the stereo sounded and the way we would move together, not like synchronized swim team style, but we did a lot of things together behind the bar in terms of service, just by peripheral vision, the way that the music would somehow coalesce with the particular course we were making. And then the room, we had these hangings over the window. So outside it's bright, bright, warm LA. And then inside it's this protected, moody, beautifully lit place. So it really seemed like you walked somewhere, you open a door to an old dry cleaner store, and then all of a sudden you're a few thousand miles away. So it was a little bit of magic. I wasn't anticipating it to feel as magical as it did. And that's a nice surprise. So it was also kind of unselfconscious too. It didn't look premeditated. It looked like it just kind of came together, and it did.
Well, the same reason why you chose Café Jacqueline as your favorite restaurant, there's some truth to that. You know, you were in search of that magic, you know, just what you're looking for when you look for in a restaurant, right? You're looking for someone who has really given so much thought and brings all of their heart and soul and talent and skill to that moment. You know, it sounds like that's what you're able to do with Blue Bottle Studio. As you were building this company, who were your inspirations? Who did you draw inspiration from?
A lot of it was, you know, my own quirky past. You know, there were books that I was very influenced by. There were visual artists, my wife at the time. There were architects. It was very much not rooted in the coffee industry. I think that's why people gravitated towards it, because it didn't seem like other coffee companies, because I wasn't even thinking about it.
Right. No, I get that. I feel that very much. I really do. I feel that all of your inspirations are apart from business. That's why I asked the question, because I knew that your answer, whatever it would be, most likely would not be, definitely not in the coffee industry, and maybe not even in business.
It wasn't Shake Shack. I mean, I like a Shake Shack burger, but yeah, I wasn't trying to be the Shake Shack of the Sweet Green of the, you know, what I used to hear in line at the kiosk, the Uber of this, the Uber of that.
Right.
That wasn't what I was interested in. I feel lucky that I got to have that time of very live creativity and that people embraced it. It seems the farther away it gets, the more unlikely it seems.
If you could collaborate with any person on a coffee project, who would you want it to be and why?
Oh, it would probably be like a musician and an architect. Both. I'm reminded, one of the novels that's been very important to me over many years is In Search of Lost Time. And I went through a phase of reading a lot about Marcel Proust and not just his novels. I remember being charmed. He wasn't able to sleep through the night. And if he in the middle of the night, sometimes he would send a messenger to a string quartet. And then, you know, 2 a.m., the string quartet would come to his apartment and perform something for Ray or something contemporary like that. And he would listen, and then he would either start writing after or try to sleep. And so I think about the Emerson String Quartet. How great would it be to have a space designed to make coffee and listen to music? There are examples of that in Japan, whereas listening bars, they've become quite popular here. Beautiful stereo, and people silently sip their black coffee. I've always been charmed by those places. But how wonderful would it be to have like a Sugimoto designed space and a residency for the Emerson String Quartet, and we come and we drink our black coffee and we don't say a damn thing. We just listen and be in some perfect space.
Oh, I love that. I love that. That's fantastic. You know, I want to be really respectful of your time. We're kind of coming to the end here, but you know, I'd be just curious as to what has kind of captured your imagination as of late, and where do you see your passions moving forward going?
Well, being in Ojai has, you know, I kind of got here in an unlikely way. It wasn't exactly where I thought I'd be, but I'm here, and my kids are here. And so I'm in this house, and down the street and across is a couple acres of avocado. And I'm this friend of mine, Joe Nagasaka, a really great architect, who I worked with in Tokyo a lot and Japan a lot, is building us a house there. It's going to be a while. So, you know, I just like this question of like working through these deep, deep ideas about kids, about love, about dinner, about light. I've been talking to Joe about a lot of those things. You know, I like to cook outside. I like to make coffee in a certain way. I've been fascinated by that. I want my kids to grow up and have this memory of these moments, these beautiful moments. The light in Ojai is very golden and beautiful. So that's what I'm working on right now. And then, you know, hopefully this creativity will spring into some more tangible thing that I can share with more people.
Well, creating memories and architecting memories for your children, I can't think of any better pursuit. That sounds magical.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that.
Yeah. Well, James, thank you for this conversation. I've really enjoyed it immensely, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, it's been so nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Dine For the podcast. For more information on the show, the guests, and the podcast, head to todinefortv.com. You can find us on Instagram at todinefortv and Facebook at todinefor with Kate Sullivan. Thanks to the sponsors of To Dine For the podcast, American National Insurance. Special thank you to producer and sound editor John Golmer. To the loyal followers of this program, cheers, stay hungry, and stay inspired. I'll see you back at the table soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.